The Lani People by J.F. Bone. Chapter 11. Mixed emotion! Ha! The author of that cliché didn't even know its meaning! Kennan strode furiously down the dusty road toward Station 1, trying to sublimate his inner conflict into action. It was useless, of course, for once he stopped moving, the grim tug-of-war between training and desire would begin again, and no matter how it ended, the result would be unsatisfactory. As long as he had been able to delude himself that he was fond of copper the way a man is fond of some lesser species, it had been all right. But he knew now that he was fond of her as a man was of a woman, and it was hell. For no rationalization in the universe would allow him to define her as human. Copper was humanoid, something like human. And to live with her and love her would not be miscegenation, which was bad enough, but bestiality, which was a thousand times worse. Although throughout most of the Brotherhood, miscegenation was an unknown word, and even bestiality had become a loose definition on many worlds with humanoid populations, the words had definite meaning and moral force to a Baton. And God help him, he was a Baton. A lifetime of training in a moral code that frowned upon mixed marriages and shrank appalled from even the thought of mixing species was nothing to bring face to face with the fact that he loved copper. It was odd, Kennan reflected bitterly, that humans could do with animals what their customs and codes prohibited them from doing to themselves. For thousands of years, back to the very dawn of history, when men had bred horses and asses to produce mules, men had been mixing species to produce useful hybrids. Yet a Baton who could hybridize plants or animals with complete equanimity shrank with horror from the thought of applying the same technique to himself. What was there about a human being that was so sacrosanct? He shook his head angrily. He didn't know. There was no answer. But the idea, the belief, was there, ingrained into his attitudes, a part of his outlook, built carefully block by block from infancy, until it now towered into a mighty wall that barred him from doing what he wished to do. It would be an easier hurdle if he had been born anywhere except on Beta. In the rest of the Brotherhood, the color of a man's skin, the shape of his face, the quality and color of his hair and eyes, made no difference. All men were brothers. But on Beta, where a variant G sun had already caused genetic divergence, the Brotherhood of Man was a term that was merely given lip service. Batons were different, and from birth they were taught to accept the difference and live with it. Mixing of Baton stock with other human species, while not actually forbidden, was so encircled with conditioning that it was a rare Baton indeed who would risk self-opprobrium and the contempt of his fellows to mate with an outsider. And as for humanoids, Kennan shuddered. He couldn't break the attitudes of a lifetime, yet he loved copper. And she knew he did. And that was an even greater horror. He had fled from the office, from the glad light in her eyes, as a burned child flees fire. He needed time to think, time to plan. Yet his body and his surface thoughts wanted no plans or time. Living with Alani wasn't frowned upon on Flora. Many of the staff did, nor did anyone seem to think less of them for doing so. Even Alexander himself had half confessed to a more than platonic affection for a Lani called Susie. Yet this was no excuse, nor would it silence the cold, still voice in his mind that kept repeating, "Sodomite, sodomite, sodomite. With a passionless inflection that was even more terrible than anger. The 5 kilometers to Station 1 disappeared unnoticed beneath his feet as he walked, and he looked up in surprise to see the white walls and red roofs of the station looming before him.
"Good Lord, Doc, what's got into you?" the station master said. "You look like you'd seen a ghost. And out in this sun without a helmet? Come inside, man, before you get sunstroke."
Kennan chuckled without humor.
"Getting sunstroke is the least of my worries, Al," he said.
But he allowed Al Crothers to usher him inside.
"It's odd that you showed up just now," Al said, his dark face showing the curiosity that filled him. "I just had a call from Message Center not 5 minutes ago, telling me to have you call in if you showed up."
Kennan sighed.
"On this island, you can't get away from the phone," he said wryly.
"Okay, where is it?"
"You look pretty bushed, Doc. Maybe you better rest a while."
"And maybe it's an emergency," Kennan interrupted. "And probably it is, because the staff can handle routine matters. So maybe you'd better show me where you keep the phone."
"One moment, please," the message center operator said. There were a few clicks in the background. "Here's your party," she continued. "Go ahead, doctor."
"Kennan?"
And her nervous voice crackled from the receiver.
"Yes?" "You're needed out on Otpen 1.
"Who is calling? And what's the rush?"
"Douglas! Douglas Alexander! The Lonnie are dying! It's an emergency! Cousin Alex will skin us alive if we let these Lonnie die!"
Douglas? Kennan hadn't thought of him since the one time they had met in Alexandria. That was a year ago. It seemed much longer, since the boss man had exiled his cousin to that bleak rock to the east of Flora. There had been no word of him.
And now,
he laughed a sharp bark of humorless annoyance.
Douglas couldn't have timed it better if he had tried.
"All right," Kennan said. "I'll come. What seems to be the trouble?"
"They're sick!" "That's obvious," Kennan snapped. "Otherwise you wouldn't be calling. Can't you tell me any more than that?"
They're vomiting. They have diarrhea. Several have had fits."
"Thanks," Kennan said. "I'll be right out. Expect me in an hour."
"So you're leaving?" Al asked as he cradled the phone.
"That's a practitioner's life," Kennan said. "Full of interruptions. Can I borrow your jeep?"
"I'll drive you. Where do you want to go?"
"To the hospital," Kennan said. "I'll have to pick up my gear. It's an emergency, all right."
"You're a tough one," Al said admiringly. "I'd hate to walk 5 kilos in this heat without a hat, and then go out on a call."
Kennan shrugged.
"It's not necessarily toughness. I believe in doing one job at a time. And my contract reads veterinary service, not personal problems. The job comes first, and there's work to do." Copper wasn't in sight when Kennan came back to the hospital, a fact for which he was grateful. He packed quickly, threw his bags into the jeep, and took off with almost guilty haste. He'd contact the hospital from the Otpens. Right now, all he wanted was to put distance between himself and Copper. Absence might make the heart grow fonder, but at the moment, propinquity was by far the more dangerous thing. He pointed the blunt nose of the jeep toward Mount Olympus, set the autopilot, opened the throttle, and relaxed as best he could as the little vehicle sped at top speed for the outer islands. A vague curiosity filled him. He'd never been on the Otpens. He wondered what they were like.
Otpen 1 was a rocky tree-clad islet, crowned with the stellate mass of a Class 2 Fortalice. But this one wasn't like Alexandria. It was fully manned and in service condition.
"Airboat," a voice crackled from the dashboard speaker of the Jeep. "Identify yourself. You are being tracked."
Kennan quickly flipped the IFF switch.
"Dr. Kennan, from Flora," he said.
"Thank you, sir. You are expected and are clear to land. Bring your vehicle down in the marked area."
A section of the roof turned a garish yellow as Kennan circled the building. He brought the Jeep in lightly, setting it carefully in the center of the area.
"Leave your vehicle," the speaker chattered. "If you are armed, leave your weapon behind."
"It's not my habit to carry a gun," Kennan snapped.
"Sorry, sir.
Regulations," the speaker said. "This is SOP. Kennan left the Jeep and instantly felt the probing tingle of a search beam. He looked around curiously at the flat roof of the fortress with its domed turrets and ugly snouts of the main battery projectors pointing skyward. Beside him, the long metal doors of a missile launcher made a rectangular trace on the smooth surface of the roof. Behind him, the central tower poked its gaunt ferromorph and duryllium outline into the darkening sky, bearing its crown of spiderweb radar antennae, turning steadily on their gimbals, covering a vast hemisphere from horizon to zenith with endless inspection. From the base of the tower, a man emerged. He was tall, taller even than Kennan, and the muscles of his body showed through the tightness of his battle dress. His face was harsh, and in his hands he carried a Burkholz Magnum, the most powerful portable weapon mankind had yet devised.
"You are Dr. Kennan?" the trooper asked.
"I am."
"Your ID, please."
Kennan handed it over, and the big man scanned the card with practiced eyes.
"Check," he said. "Follow me, sir."
"My bags," Kennan said.
"They'll be taken care of."
Kennan shrugged and followed the man into the tower. A modern grav shaft lowered them to the ground floor. They passed through a gloomy caricature of the Great Hall in Alexandria, through an iris, and down a long corridor lined with doors. A bell rang.
"Back," the trooper said. "Against the wall. Quick, into the doorway."
"What's up?"
"Another practice alert." The trooper's voice was bored. "It gets so you'd almost wish for a fight to relieve the monotony."
A trooper and several Lonnie came down the corridor, running in disciplined formation. Steel clanged on steel as they turned the corner, and moments later the whine of servos came faintly to their ears. From somewhere deep in the pile, a rising crescendo of generators under full battle load sent out vibrations that could be sensed rather than heard. A klaxon squawked briefly. There was another clash of metal, and a harsh voice boomed through the corridors.
14 seconds! Well done! Secure stations!
The trooper grinned.
"That ties the record," he said. "We can go now."
The corridor ended abruptly at an iris flanked by two sentries. They conferred briefly with Kennan's guide, dilated the iris, and motioned for Kennan to enter. The pastel interior of the modern office was a shocking contrast to the gray ferromorph corridors outside. Douglas Alexander was standing behind the desk. He was much the same. His pudgy face was haggard with uncertainty, and his eyes darted back and forth as his fingers caressed the knobby grip of a small Burkholz jutting from a holster at his waist. There were new unpleasant furrows between his eyes. He looked older, and the indefinable air of cruelty was more pronounced. He had been frightened the last time Kennan saw him, and he was frightened now.
"I'm not sure whether I am glad to see you, Kennan," he said uncertainly. "But I suppose I have to be."
Kennan believed him.
"How have you been?" Kennan asked. "Not too bad, until this afternoon. Things have been going pretty well."
He shifted uncomfortably from one foot to the other.
"I suppose Cousin Alex will skin me for this, but there's nothing else I can do."
He licked his lips.
"You've been here long enough, and you'll have to know eventually."
He fidgeted and finally sat down behind the desk.
"We have trouble. Half the Lonnie were stricken about 4 hours ago. It was sudden. No warning at all. And if they die..."
His voice trailed off.
"Well, what are we waiting for? Get someone to bring my bags down here and we'll look them over."
"Do you have to? Can't you prescribe something?"
"How? I haven't examined the patients."
"I can tell you what's wrong."
Kennan smiled. "I hardly think that's the way to do it. Even though your description might be accurate, you still might miss something of critical importance." Douglas sighed.
"I thought that's what you'd say," he said. "Oh, very well. You might as well see what we have out here."
"You can't possibly believe that I don't already know," Kennan said. "You have male Lonnie." Douglas looked at him, his face blank with surprise.
"But how did you know?"
"No one on the main island does, except the family. And we never talk about it."
"Did Ella Weese tell you? I noticed she was struck with you the day you came. And the Lonnie who have come out here since have been talking about you two. Did she do it?" Kennan shook his head.
"She never said a word."
"Then how?"
"I'm not stupid," Kennan said. "That story you've spread about artificial fertilization has more holes in it than a sieve. That technique has been investigated 1,000 times, and it has never worked past the first generation. If you had been using it, the Lonnie would long ago have been extinct. Haploids don't reproduce, and the only way the diploid number of chromosomes can be kept is to replace those lost by maturation division of the ovum. You might be able to keep the diploid number by using immature ova, but the fertilization technique would be far more complex than the simple uterine injections you use at Hillside Station."
Douglas looked at him blankly.
"Besides," Kennan added, "I have a microscope. I checked your so-called fertilizing solution. I found spermatozoa, and spermatozoa only come from males. Once more, the males have to be the same species as the females, or fertilization will not take place. So there must be male Lonnie. Nothing else fits. You've been using artificial insemination on the main island Lonnie, and from the way this place is guarded, it's obvious that here is your stud farm."
Douglas shrugged and spread his hands in a gesture of resignation.
"I suppose," he said, "that's the way old Doc found out, too. We never told him, but he knew before he ever came out here." "The only thing that puzzles me," Kennan went on, "is how you managed to eliminate the Y chromosome carriers within the sperm."
"Eh?"
"The male sex determinant. Half the sperm carry it, but so far as I know, there's never been a male born on the main island."
"Oh, that! It's something that's done in the labs here. Probably one of the technicians could tell you. It's called electrofreezing, or something like that."
"Electrodiaphoresis?" Douglas nodded.
That sounds like it.
I don't know anything about it. One of Grandfather's men did the basic work. We just follow instructions.
He shrugged.
Well, since you know the secret, there's no sense in hiding the bodies. Come along and tell me what's wrong.
It was a peculiar feeling to walk down the row of cubicle rooms with their barred doors. The whole area reminded him of a historical novel, of the prisons of early human history, where men confined other men for infractions of social customs. The grimness of the place was appalling. The male Lonnie, impressive in their physical development, were in miserable condition, nauseated, green-faced, retching. The sickening odors of vomit and diarrhea hung heavily on the air. Douglas coughed and held a square of cloth to his face. And even Kennan, strong-stomached as he was, could feel his viscera twitch in sympathy with the caged sufferers.
"Great Fleming, man!" Kennan exploded. "You can't keep them here! Get them out! Give them some fresh air! This place would make a well man sick!"
Douglas looked at him.
"I wouldn't take one of them out unless I had him shackled and there was an armed guard to help me. Those males are the most vicious, cunning, and dangerous animals on Cardan. They exist with but one thought in mind. To kill."
Kennan looked curiously through a barred door at one of the Lonnie. He lay on a bear cot, a magnificently muscled figure with a ragged black beard hiding his face. There were dozens of scars on his body, and one angry purple area on his thick right forearm where flesh had been torn away not too long ago. Beads of sweat stood out on his forehead, and soft moaning noises came from his tight lips as he pressed his abdomen with thick-fingered hands.
"He doesn't look so dangerous," Kennan said. "Watch it," Douglas warned. "Don't get too close."
But the warning was too late. Kennan touched the bars, and as he did, the Lonnie moved with fluid speed, one huge hand clutching Kennan's sleeve and pulling him against the bars, while the other darted for his throat. Fingers bit into Kennan's neck and tightened in a vice-like grip. Kennan reacted automatically. His arms came up inside the Lonnie's and crashed down, elbows out, tearing the Lonnie loose. He jumped back, rubbing his bruised throat.
"That fellow's not sick," he gasped. "He's crazy."
The Lonnie glared at him through the bars, disappointment written on his scarred and bearded face.
"I warned you," Douglas said. His voice held an undertone of malicious laughter. "He must be sick, or he would have killed you. George is clever in a stupid sort of way."
Kennan looked into the cubicle.
The Lonnie glared back and growled. There was a beast-like note in his voice that made the short hairs on Kennan's neck prickle.
"That fellow needs a lesson," he said.
"You want to give it to him?"
Douglas asked. "Not particularly."
"Ha! Man! You afraid!" the Lonnie taunted. His voice was thick and harsh. "All men fear me. All Lonnie, too. I am boss. Come close again, man, and I kill you."
"Are they all that stupid?" Kennan asked. "He sounds like a homicidal moron."
"He's not stupid," Douglas said. "Just uneducated."
"Why is he so murderous?"
"That's his training. All his life he has fought. From childhood his life has been based upon his ability to survive in an environment where every male is his enemy. You see here the sublimation of individuality. He cannot cooperate with another male. He hates them, and they in turn hate him. George here is a perfect example of absolute freedom from restraint."
Douglas smiled unpleasantly.
"His whole history is one of complete lack of control. As an infant, being male, his mother thought she was favored by the gods, and she denied him nothing. In fact, we were quite insistent that she gave him everything he wanted. By the time he was able to walk and take care of himself, he was completely spoiled, selfish, and authoritative. Then we took him and a dozen others exactly like him and put them together.
Douglas grinned.
You should see what happens when a dozen spoiled brats are forced to live together. It's more fun. The little beasts hate each other on sight, and we stimulate them to compete for toys, food, and drink. Never quite enough to go around. You can imagine what happens. Instead of sharing, each little selfish individualist fights to get everything he can grab. Except for one thing, we don't punish them whatever what they do. Except for one thing, we don't punish them no matter what they do. If anyone shows signs of cooperating, he is disciplined severely the first time. The next time he is called. But other than that, we leave them alone. They develop their personalities and their muscles, and if one proves to be too much for his fellows, we transfer him to a more advanced class where the competition is keener, and he learns what it is to lose. At puberty, we add sex drive to the basics, and by the time our male reaches maturity, we have something like George. Actually, George is more mature than either you or I. He has all the answers he needs. He's strong, solitary, authoritative, and selfish. He has no curiosity and resents encroachment. He's a complete individualist. If he proves out, he should make an excellent sire.
But isn't he dangerous to handle? Kenan asked.
Yes, but we take precautions.
Kenan grimaced with distaste.
Look at it objectively, Douglas said. We're trying to select the best physical type we can, in the hope that he'll pass his qualities to his offspring, and there's no better practical way to select the strongest and hardiest than by natural selection. We control their environment as little as possible and let nature do our educating until they're old enough to be useful. Naturally, there's some things which we cannot provide, such as exposure to disease, to the elements, and to predators. The one isn't selective about whom it infects, while the others would tend to produce cooperation as a matter of survival.
Isn't there a great deal of mortality under such a regimen?
Not as much as you'd expect. It's about 20%. And there is a great deal of compensation from a management viewpoint. We get essentially the same physical end product as we would from a closely managed operation, plus a great savings in labor. Males, you see, are fairly expendable. We only need a few per year. It's brutal.
So it is, but
life is brutal. Still, it's efficient for our purposes. We merely take advantage of natural impulses to produce a better product. Grandfather got the idea out of an old book, something about the noble savage, natural selection, and survival of the fittest. He thought it was great, said there was nothing like relentless competition to bring out the strongest and hardiest types. And he's been right for centuries. Can you imagine anything much better than George, from a physical viewpoint?
He is a magnificent animal, Kenan admitted as he eyed the Lani. But it seems to me that you could train some obedience into him.
Douglas shook his head. That would introduce a modifying factor, something bigger and more powerful than the male himself. And that would modify the result. We can control them well enough with knockout gas and shackles. And those things, oddly enough, don't destroy their pride or self-esteem. They think that we use them because we are afraid, and it satisfies their egos. Kenan eyed the caged Lonnie dubiously.
"This is going to be difficult. I must examine them and treat them, but if they're all as homicidal as this one..."
"You fight me, man!" George interrupted, his face twisted into lines of transparent guile. "I am boss, and others do as I say. You beat me, then you are boss."
"Is this true?" Kenan asked.
"Oh, it's true enough," Douglas said. "George is the leader, and if you beat him, you'd be top male until some other one got courage enough to challenge you. But he's just trying to get his hands on you. He'd like to kill."
Kenan looked at the big humanoid appraisingly. George was huge, at least 5 centimeters taller and 15 kilograms heavier than himself. And he was all muscle.
"I don't think I'd care to accept that challenge unless I was forced to," Kenan said.
Douglas chuckled.
"I don't blame you."
Kenan sighed.
"It looks like we are going to need reinforcements to get these brutes under control. I'm not going in there with them, and I can't examine them from out here."
"Oh, we can hold them all right. Paralysis gas and shackles will keep them quiet. There's no need to bother the troopers. We can handle this by ourselves."
Kenan shrugged.
"It's your baby. You should know what you're doing."
"I do," Douglas said confidently. "Wait here until I get the gas capsules and the equipment."
He turned and walked back to the entrance to the cell block. At the iris he turned.
"Be careful," he said.
"Don't worry, I will." Kenan looked at George through the bars, and the humanoid glared back, his eyes bright with hatred. Kenan felt the short hairs prickle along the back of his neck. George roused a primal emotion, an elemental dislike that was deeper than reason, an antagonism intensely physical, almost overpowering, a purely adrenal response that had no business in the makeup of a civilized human. He had thought the Lonnie had a number of human traits until he had encountered George. But if George was a typical male, then the Lonnie were alien. He flexed his muscles and stared coldly into the burning blue eyes behind the bars. There would be considerable satisfaction in beating this monstrosity to a quivering pulp. Millennia of human preeminence. Of belief that nothing, no matter how big or muscular, should fail to recognize that a man's person was inviolate, fed the fuel of his anger. The most ferocious beasts on 10,000 worlds had learned this lesson, and yet this animal had laid hands on him with intent to kill. A cold corner of his mind kept telling him that he wasn't behaving rationally. But he disregarded it. George was a walking need for a lesson in manners.
"Don't get the idea that I'm afraid of you, you over-muscled oaf," Kenan snapped. "I can handle you or anyone like you. And if you put your hands on me again, I'll beat you within an inch of your worthless life."
The Lonnie snarled.
"Let me out and I kill you. But you are like all men. You use gun and iron. Not fair fight."
Douglas returned with a gas capsule and a set of shackles.
"All right," he said. "We are ready for him."
He handed Kenan the shackles and a key to the cell door and drew his Burkholz.
"See," the Lonnie growled. "It is as I say. Men are cowards."
"You know gun?"
Douglas asked as he pointed the muzzle of the Burkholz at the Lonnie.
"I know," George growled. "Gun kill."
"It does indeed," Douglas said. "Now get back. Clear back again."